Okay, imagine this. You're at home, maybe alone. Suddenly, there's this frantic banging at your door.
Okay.
You open it. Someone's there, terrified, pleading, help me. Someone's chasing me with an axe. You pull them inside, hide them, maybe in a closet. Barely a second later, another knock. Really violent this time.
Oh, wow.
It's the person with the axe. And they demand, where are they? Did they come in here? What do you do? Seriously? Do you have to tell the truth?
It's that classic ethical puzzle, isn't it? And, you know, if you grew up, like a lot of us did, with that very simplified Sunday school version of the Ninth Commandment, just, you shall not lie, well,
right,
that puts you in a pretty bad predicament. You know, staring down an axe murderer, knowing you supposedly can't say, nope, nobody here, because, well, that'd be a lie.
And a lie breaks the commandment. According to that simple view, it feels impossible.
Exactly. An impossible situation.
But you're suggesting that maybe that common interpretation, thou shalt not lie,
it
might be missing something, something crucial from the original text.
That's a good way to put it, yeah. That common translation, it can kind of lead us down the wrong path, making it seem like any untruth is forbidden, which wasn't really the main point.
Okay, so what is the actual wording then, the original?
The actual wording is much more precise. It's, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor.
Bear false witness against your neighbor.
Okay.
And that phrasing, that's the key for our deep dive today.
Exactly.
We're going to unpack what that really meant originally. Look at the history, the context, the frankly devastating real world impact it had, and how it goes way beyond just simple honesty. It touches on the power, the responsibility of all our words.
You might be surprised how relevant it still is, even in, you know, modern situations.
Right, let's get into it. So, bearing false witness. That sounds pretty specific.
It does, doesn't it? It immediately points to a particular setting, a courtroom, basically, or some kind of legal forensic situation.
So fundamentally, it means don't commit perjury.
That's the absolute core of it, yes. Don't lie under oath in a way that harms someone else legally.
And what's really interesting is, you were saying this idea, worrying about false testimony in court, it wasn't brand new with Moses or the Torah.
Oh, not at all. It was practically an obsession in many ancient Near Eastern law codes going back centuries before Moses.
Wow.
An obsession.
Yeah, you see it pop up again and again, but they handled it differently.
Take the Code of Ur-Nammu, for instance. It was relatively lenient.
Okay.
If you were proven to be a perjurer, you'd pay, I think it was 15 shekels of silver. Or maybe just make a payment if you withdrew your oath. Kind of. Well, generous for back then.
15 shekels?
Yeah.
Compared to what? What about Hammurabi's code? I hear that was harsher.
Oh, dramatically harsher. With Hammurabi, the stakes were life and death. If you accused someone of a capital crime, something punishable by death, and you couldn't prove it, you were put to death. Simple as that. No fines.
Whoa.
And then there was the famous or infamous trial by river.
The trial by river. What was that?
Okay, so you accuse someone, they're taken to the river and basically have to jump in. If they sink, guilty. And you, the accuser, you get their house.
Seriously?
Seriously. But if the river somehow, you know, prove them innocent, maybe they swam or floated and they escaped unharmed.
Then what?
Then you, the accuser, were put to death and your house went to the person you falsely accused.
Unbelievable. The stakes were just astronomical. It really makes you pause and think about the weight of even making an accusation back then.
It absolutely does. And this idea, this sort of reciprocal justice, what you intended for another, happens to you. It wasn't just Hammurabi. We see it reflected right in the Torah.
In Deuteronomy, right.
Exactly. Deuteronomy 19. It mirrors Hammurabi's principle pretty closely. If a malicious witness falsely accused someone, the rule was, you shall do to him as he had meant to do to his brother.
So, eye for an eye, almost literally.
Pretty much. It applied to property, too. If your false testimony aimed to take their land, you'd lose your own. If it aimed to get them killed, well, you'd face execution.
So the consequences were just devastating. Perjury could literally cost your neighbor their life.
That's the power it held. Think about the story of Susanna and the elders from the Apocrypha.
Okay, yeah.
You have these two lecherous old men who try to blackmail Susanna, a virtuous woman. They threaten to bear false witness, accuse her of adultery, which was a capital crime if she doesn't, you know, comply with them.
Horrible.
She refuses, screams for help, and they go ahead and make the false accusation. But then young Daniel steps in. divinely inspired, the Sonari says.
And he catches them out, right?
Brilliantly. He separates them and asks each one, okay, if you saw this happen, under which specific tree did it happen? One says one tree, the other says a different one. Their lie is exposed.
And they end up being punished.
They're put to death, exactly. The penalty they intended for Susanna falls on them.
A great example of the principle. But then there were really tragic cases, like Naboth's vineyard. That one always stuck with me.
Absolutely. Book of Kings. King Ahab wants Naboth's vineyard. Naboth won't sell. It's his family inheritance.
Right. Sacred land, almost.
So Queen Jezebel steps in. She basically hires two scoundrels.
Sons of Belial, the text calls them, I think.
That's right. She bribes them to falsely accuse Naboth of blasphemy against God and the king. Another capital offense.
And based on their false testimony,
Naboth is dragged out and stoned to death, and Ahab takes the vineyard, just like that.
And the text says, God saw it all.
It makes that point very clear. And you know, what's crucial here, the Old Testament actually had a rule requiring two witnesses for a capital conviction. You couldn't execute someone based on just one person's testimony.
Ah, safeguard.
Supposedly. But as the Naboth story tragically shows, if people were determined enough, they could still find two people willing to lie together.
So these stories, Susanna, Naboth, they really highlight the moral dimension, don't they? It feels like more than just legal rules, like these commandments are vows people make.
That's a great way to think about it. Vows, agreements in their hearts, not to harm others through their actions and, crucially, through their words.
Which suggests that even though the language starts in the courtroom, bearing false witness isn't only about perjury.
Exactly right. While the language is rooted there, the principle expands outwards.
So the real core, then, is about the words themselves and the intent, not just ticking a legal box.
Precisely. The primary intention behind the commandment is about using words, any words, that are meant to bring harm to another person. That malicious intent is the key.
Okay, so that helps clarify things. It's not necessarily about, say, those little everyday fibs.
Right.
Like telling a kid their drawing is, oh, that's lovely, dear. You're so talented. Even if, you know, you're maybe lying through your teeth a little bit.
Yes, exactly. Or, you know, a wife telling her husband he looks even more handsome now than he did in college.
Even if it's maybe not objectively true.
Right. Those aren't malicious. They're not intended to harm. Often they're meant to encourage or build someone up or just maintain harmony. They don't violate the spirit of this commandment because the harmful intent is missing.
Okay. That distinction is helpful, but it does bring up something else. Something maybe a bit disconcerting, which is that sometimes in the Old Testament you see figures, even respected figures, and sometimes even God using deception, but for what seems like a good reason.
Yes, that's a really complex and fascinating part of the text. It can be disconcerting, but maybe also in a way comforting.
How so?
Well, you see Abraham fibbing about Sarah being his sister, supposedly to protect himself. You see Rahab outright lying to protect the Israelite spies in Jericho.
And she's praised for it later, right? Considered righteous.
She is, yes. And Michal, David's wife, lies to Saul's men to save David's life. And then there's that really bizarre case in 1 Kings 22.
Oh, the lying spirit.
Yes, where God apparently sends a lying spirit into the mouths of Ahab's prophets to deliberately mislead him and lure him to his death. It's a tough passage.
It really is. So what's the guiding principle we take from all that? How do we make sense of it alongside don't bear false witness?
I think the key takeaway, the underlying principle, seems to be this. A falsehood told with genuinely good intention, especially to protect life or prevent greater harm, can be seen as more virtuous than telling a truth that is deliberately hurtful or destructive.
So, intent again.
Intent is paramount. What the Bible consistently condemns, without exception, is using lies, using falsehoods, specifically to hurt other people. That's the line, malicious deception is always wrong.
Okay, that makes sense. And this idea of words intended to harm, that definitely opens the door to talking about gossip and slander, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It's a natural extension. In fact, Leviticus 19 explicitly broadens the idea. It says, do not go about spreading slander among your people. Some translations use talebearer or gossip.
And the original Hebrew word there is interesting, isn't it? Rakil.
Very insightful. Rakil can mean spreading a false report, slander in that sense, but it can also mean spreading a true report that is harmful or divisive.
So even telling the truth can be gossip if the intent or the effect is harmful.
Exactly. Some truths, frankly, are better left unsaid. They don't build up, they just tuck down.
Like Proverbs says.
What is it?
A troublemaker sows discord, and a gossip separates close friends.
Precisely. Proverbs 16:28.
It often happens by revealing private things, things told in confidence, or just things that are nobody else's business.
And Jesus takes this even further, doesn't he?
He does. In Matthew 15, when he's talking about what defiles a person, he lists things that come from the heart, evil thoughts, murder, adultery.
Yeah.
And right there alongside them, he includes false testimony and slander. He clearly links harmful words like gossip and rumor mongering to the same kind of internal evil thoughts.
Yeah, powerful. Yeah. But why do we do it? Why do people seem to enjoy gossip so much? Is it just feeling important, like you're in the know?
That's definitely a big part of it, I think. That little thrill of having secret information, the social status it can sometimes bring, maybe feeling special.
Yeah.
But it can also be, unfortunately, a way to bond with others over shared disapproval of someone else. Or maybe even a subconscious thing, trying to make ourselves feel better by pointing out flaws in others.
Mm.
Charles Allen, in his book God Psychiatry, had that great line, "Great minds discuss ideas, average minds discuss events, small minds discuss people."
Ouch. But there's truth there.
There really is. It highlights how easy it is to slip into talking about people instead of engaging with bigger things, and often without thinking about the damage.
You mentioned your grandfather's story before,
mm-hmm.
the minister. That really illustrates the damage, doesn't it?
It really does, yeah. He was serving a church, and this one woman just kept spreading this rumor about him giving rides home to another woman in the church, Sister Gert, implying something improper was going on. Well, eventually he heard about it and had to address it publicly. He explained, "Actually, it's my wife, my grandmother, who's been giving Sister Gert a ride home because I've been busy after the service."
So clarification, that should have ended it.
You'd think, but no. The rumor just mutated. Now, the gossip was that my grandmother must be having an affair with Sister Gert.
Oh, come on.
I know. It was absurd. But the damage was done. The suspicion, the whispers. It completely undermined his ministry there. He eventually had to leave the church because of it. A baseless rumor, twisted and turned, destroyed his effectiveness there.
That's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And it shows how fast this stuff can spread and how impossible it is to control once it's out.
Yeah.
It reminds me of that old shampoo commercial from the 80s.
Oh, yes. I told two friends and they told two friends and so on and so on.
Exactly. That exponential spread.
It's a perfect analogy. I actually I ran the numbers on that once just out of curiosity.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. If one person starts a story on Sunday and tells just two friends, and then on Monday, those two each tell two more, and everyone just tells two new people each day.
Okay.
In just 2 weeks, 14 days, you know how many people would have heard that story?
I dread to think. A lot.
Almost 32,000 people.
32,000?
Yeah.
From just telling two friends a day.
Oh.
Wow.
It's staggering, isn't it? And keep going for a month. You could reach the entire population of a city like Chicago.
Good grief.
Now think about it. That's based on telling just two people. If the story is really, really juicy gossip,
people aren't stopping it.
Exactly. It's going to spread much faster, much wider. Imagine the sheer volume of destructive news, the harm that can be done by just one carelessly spoken rumor taking flight like that.
And once it's out there, you can't just gather back up.
Which brings us perfectly to that powerful rabbinic legend about the man named Yaakov.
Right, the one who spread a rumor about his rabbi.
Yes, he got angry, started a false story. A few days later, he hears his own rumor being repeated back to him by someone else, someone who barely knew him or the rabbi, and he feels terrible, genuinely repentant. He goes to the rabbi to apologize and ask for forgiveness.
And the rabbi gives him a task, a penance.
Exactly. First part of the penance, take a big feather pillow, brand new, go cut it open, and then I want you to walk through the entire town and place one single feather on the doorstep of every single house where your rumor has spread.
Every house? That must have been the whole town.
Pretty much. Yaakov, wanting to make amends, does it, carefully places a feather on every single doorstep, knowing his words had reached everywhere. It takes him days.
Okay, so he finishes that part, then what?
He goes back to the rabbi, exhausted, but feeling he's done the first task. The rabbi then says, "Good, now for the second part of your penance. Go back out and collect every single one of those feathers, gather them all up, bring them back here, and put them back into the pillowcase. Make the pillow whole again, just as it was before."
Oh, no.
Yaakov is just stunned, utterly despairing. He says, "Rabbi, that's impossible what you're asking. It can't be done. The wind has taken those feathers by now. They're scattered everywhere. There's no way I can find them all, let alone put the pillow back together."
And that was the point, wasn't it?
That was the profound lesson. The rabbi looks at him sadly and says, "And now, my son, You understand what your words have done to me. Like those feathers, your words have scattered far and wide, and the damage they have caused can never be completely undone.
Wow, that hits hard.
It's such a powerful image, isn't it? Gossip, slander, even truths that maybe are better kept private. They can destroy reputations, relationships. Our words, once spoken, can truly take wing and fly to places we never intended, or sometimes they come home to roost in ways we didn't expect.
So, wrapping up this deep dive then, it's clear the Ninth Commandment is so much more than just don't tell lies.
Oh, absolutely. It's fundamentally about the immense power packed into our words and the deep responsibility we have to use them carefully, constructively.
It really boils down to being careful, being mindful about how we use words and how they might injure our neighbors, whether legally, socially, or emotionally.
Exactly. It moves way beyond just that initial courtroom setting into really every conversation we have.
And it leaves us with that sobering thought you mentioned earlier from Jesus himself. You will have to give account on the day of judgment for every empty word you have spoken.
Every idle word, some translations say.
Every idle word. It really makes you stop and think, doesn't it? About the weight of our everyday communication, every comment, every text, every post online. What's the intent? Are these words building up? Or could they, even unintentionally, be tearing someone down like those scattered feathers?
Definitely something to reflect on as you go about your week in all your interactions. How are you using the power of your words?